Hello and welcome to the second episode of the Blue Tech Research Thought Leadership Interview Series. Here at Blue Tech, innovation in the water sector is our favourite subject to discuss. Did you know that just under 10% of water technology innovations have a successful application? And even then, the impact is often disappointing. If you're wondering why this is the case, then this is certainly the podcast episode for you. Towards the end of last year, Paul O'Callaghan, the CEO and founder at Blue Tech Research, was awarded his PhD at Wanagan University on the dynamics of water innovation. The PhD aimed to provide insights into the rate of adoption, diffusion, and success of innovative water technology companies globally. As well as discussing what makes certain innovations successful in his PhD, he also presented the water technology adoption model, which can be used to monitor the spread of innovations. In this highly anticipated episode, Paul will speak to one of the challengers of his PhD, Reinhard Hubner, the CEO at Skion Water. In this episode, Paul and Reinhard will unpack the different types of innovation, rates of success, adoption, and give some very valuable advice to startups in the water industry. This episode is certainly not one to be missed.
Paul, we had the joy of being opponents when you defended your PhD. You spent the last years researching the dynamics of innovation in water, and we both are very passionate about the topic of innovation in water. You with your work around technology in the water sector, me investing into some of this. So it's great to talk today about some of the insights of your PhD, and I look forward to challenging you in a bit different way than at the defense. Let's start talking about innovation in water in general a bit. I am sure pretty much everybody agrees with us that innovation is needed to address the challenges we face in the water sector. As part of your research, you developed a technology adoption model in the water sector. What are the key insights from that sector, from that model, sorry?
And the key insight for us is that there are normal time frames in which you move through the adoption cycle. The adoption cycle is well known. We have the innovators, the early adopters, the early majority. Water technologies are no different. The key insight was that although it moves slowly, it does move and it doesn't take forever. And we found that if you looked at enough water technologies over the years, it can take about 12 to 16 years from when an idea is first taken out of a laboratory and piloted to the point when that becomes a technology in the market that's relatively widely adopted with multiple suppliers. That time frame of 12 to 16 years put data on something that maybe had been intuitively felt by people, but there was really nothing that you could point to that would support that.
If I'm a bit cynical now, Paul, then the 12 to 16 years is what it took the CD to wipe out the vinyl disc and the tape, and then MP3 to wipe out the CD. So while you say it doesn't take forever, it moves. It's still mind-bogglingly slow compared to other parts of our universe. So what is the cause for the fact that in water, the adoption actually is relatively slow?
Well, you know, whenever you have change, right, there's generational cycles there. When people began to study genetics, they used fruit flies back in the day, okay, because they're relatively quick life cycles. And you could observe changes quickly in patterns. And when Clayton Christensen looked at his disruptive innovation theory, he referred to hard disks as the fruit fly of the tech industry. You could go from a 6-inch to an 8-inch to a 12-inch within 1.5 to 2 to 2.5 years. One could replace the other. So things which have fast replacement cycles are good for adoption. Water is like, you know, these things last quite a long period of time, 20, 30 years, maybe 50. And some of our technologies have been with us for 100 years. So you have that playing against you is your longevity of cycle. We also have the fact that it's regulated. So, you know, our cars, right, the car that I grew up in the 1980s, my parents were driving, didn't have rear reversing mirrors in it. It didn't have heated car seats. It didn't have all these things. But over time, you persuade me that it's nicer to have a car that has those things. Within water, you don't really have the same ability to keep adding on functionality over time. You've got to kind of meet the targets. You know, produce clean drinking water that's safe. So unless there's a crisis that drives you to have to do something new, like maybe add airbags in a car because safety regulations required, or safety belts, the consumer the utility isn't so driven to want a slightly nicer version of a wastewater treatment plant with a little bit of additional functionality. So you have those issues to contend with.
I think that's a good point. I mean, when I look back at the times I worked in utility operations, you would always think about, if this goes wrong, I'll be front page of the newspaper. If this goes well, will I get a thank you? Maybe, maybe not. So there's also an element of risk assessment, risk aversion in critical infrastructure that comes on top of the cycles. And indeed, the cycles can be 100 years easily if you put pipes in the ground. Yeah, I very much agree with that. And then you just alluded to the exceptions to that rule being more crisis-driven. Can you elaborate a bit on crisis-driven innovation versus other types of innovation in water?
Sure. So we have the sustaining innovation, which is every year somebody launches the new latest model of whatever it is they had last year, and it's a little bit better, it uses a little bit less energy, and that goes on quite well. The sector is good at that.
So this is what I wouldn't even call innovation. It's incremental improvement in my view, because innovation is by definition for me something that is fundamentally different from what was done before.
It needs a different, like it's done by different people. It's done in a different way. It's introduced to the market in a different way. So it is very different. It is incremental improvement.
Yeah.
And incremental improvement is, there's no problem with incremental improvement really in the water sector. It's what companies compete on over time. Big challenge for them is, can you charge more? Because water charges are often viewed as indirect taxation by consumers. And, you know, while I might be willing to pay extra for, you know, that feature in my car, people don't necessarily want to pay extra for water because it's something that they don't perceive as a value to them. You know, it's still the same water as far as they're concerned. And the crisis driven, so the whole of the water sector, there was no such thing as a water industry, you know, 150 years ago, until people began to realize they needed water in cities for putting out fires after the Great Fire of London. That was a crisis. Then once they had the water, they could do other things. They could flush toilets, and that created need for sanitation. Of course, people discovered that water made you ill. That wasn't known before John Snow discovered that with the famous John Snow pump in London. That led to chlorination. The idea of putting chlorine into water was completely radical. Like, people just had never contemplated such a thing. But within about 10 or 20 years, over 80% of all drinking water treatment plants in the United States were using chlorine. That's a very fast rate of adoption of chlorine from what was a radical idea, but it was driven by a crisis. People were dying. You don't get a bigger crisis than that. Then we had the environmental crisis, where rivers were dying, fish were dying, and that led to the environmental movement, the US EPA Clean Watersheds Needs Act in 1972. And that's relatively recent. And we're still catching up in some parts of Europe, and we're still catching up in many, many parts of the world in terms of that. But once you meet those basic needs of crisis and you get things stable and it's working, you know, what do you do then?
I think that's a good point, that adoption can actually be fast when facing a crisis. And that is obviously something we don't want crisis to just have innovation, but we happily accept when somebody solves a crisis with innovation, and are thankful for that. Is there another way to speed up the adoption of technologies than just a crisis? Say, for example, by superior economics of a new solution or something like that?
Well, that's value-driven innovation, where something is simply, it's better, it's cheaper, it's faster, it's more economical, and it doesn't need a crisis. It could be that, for example, aeration devices used to use surface aerators, and then people came up with fine bubble diffusers, and they completely replaced surface aerators, not because there was any regulation or that you couldn't aerate the water. You could, but this was so much more efficient that it completely replaced it. That was a really good example of a value-driven innovation that took over.
I fully agree, Paul. That's a nice example. We are still replacing surface aerators with some of our customers every once in a while. So the diffusion isn't finished yet. Other examples that come to my mind from recent innovation is the Nereda process that I have seen gain traction quite quickly. And also thermal hydrolysis, where I feel, at least in some countries, there's real traction. And both are based on financial benefits for the user. Do you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, Nereda's been a really interesting one to watch, actually, and looking at the data of how fast it moved We can see that it took 5 years approximately from when they put in their very first plant in 2005, that was Royal Haskoning GHV. If we take the first 5 years that it took to get the three full scale, and then the next 8 years that it took to get to the early majority, that's 13 years in total. That's quite in keeping with your classical timeline for a value-driven innovation. And it was driven by the fact that it has lower energy use, doesn't require a clarifier. They can retrofit it in certain instances where you have an SVR, they do need a certain depth of the tank in order to go back and retrofit it. But that meant they could quickly find a market opportunity in some existing plants. Now, the next challenge will be once they've exhausted that opportunity, how can they make it other easier to retrofit into more existing plants that vary in their design work or indeed expand into new greenfield opportunities?
And I think Nereda managed to capture a relevant part of the retrofit, the new build market, actually, right? So if you look at quite a bit of the new build in certain parts, it's not Nereda. When you are open for an SBR, right? Not everybody wants an SBR for obvious reasons.
The ideal situation is when you've got both a retrofit opportunity and a greenfield opportunity. That's the absolute perfect scenario.
Yeah.
And they have a little bit of both. And then maybe to pick up on your example of thermal hydrolysis, what we saw was that Cambi commissioned their first plant in 1996. I mean, I was barely out of university at this point in time. And I do remember the first papers being presented at conferences on Cambi back in the late 1990s. Now, it took them 4 years from there to get the first three full scale installations. That's not bad. You know, 4 years from zero to three is about average. It took them another 11 years to move into the early majority section of the market. So that's maybe a little bit slower than what we would see, to be fair. They were delayed by some engineering challenges, some issues at the first full scale plants that kind of held them back a little bit. And if we look at how long did it take them to go from five plants to 50, it took them 13 years. So to 10x it from 5 to 50 took them 13 years. So a little bit longer than Cambi, which was significantly longer than for Nereda, which took only 7 years. And, you know, I think what you see here is it's a value-driven innovation, but people do not have to use it. And what we're generally seeing is that in that type of situation, it can hit a ceiling in that you can get a certain level of adoption, but unless there's some form of regulation or crisis that really drives it, it can begin to stall out to some extent, in that even now, 25 plus years later, there are about 120 Cambi thermal hydrolysis plants in existence in the world today. And that is still relatively, it's a very small number in the overall greater scheme of things, even though it has been very successful in terms of commercializing the technology.
Yeah, it's a good point. Also, the distinction you made on this being something that is more difficult to retrofit because it's a fundamental change of the process. When you install a Cambi system, a thermal hydrolysis system in a wastewater treatment plant, whereas other examples like the aerators is just the same process made more efficient, there's almost no risk attached to that, whereas changing the process is always with risks and major disruptions of the operations.
It's a new piece of equipment. It has to be operated in a certain way. It operates at relatively high temperatures for the water sector, relatively high pressures for the water sector. So there's expertise you need to do it. Nereda is interesting and it's quite subjective. Some people might view that as sustaining innovation because it's an improvement in the activated sludge process. Others might say it's discontinuous because you eliminate the need for a secondary clarifier. So it sits somewhere in the middle. But the beauty of it is it's a process change to a well-accepted process that's already there in existence and people are used to building.
Yeah. And the CapEx saving is substantial. I mean, if you save 30% of the CapEx in building a new plant, that is something that is very attractive.
That moves the needle. When you're at that level of efficiency gain, you're going to drive adoption. That's what we've seen.
Yeah. Okay, maybe let's use that opportunity to take the investor perspective. The work you did can also be very helpful for investors who want to assess water technology companies looking for funding. How can your research be leveraged for investors to make smarter investment decisions?
I think that it can provide a useful framework for investors who are, or indeed for entrepreneurs, as they look at their technologies and what the potential is. So, first thing I would ask, if something came across your desk tomorrow, it would be, what's going to drive the adoption of this technology? Is it value driven or is it going to be driven by a crisis or an acute need? And both are okay, as long as you then say, okay, I'm going to set my expectations accordingly in terms of the timeline. This, if this is going to be driven by value, we need to take a longer term view on the timeline to real impact in the world. And it can sit in your portfolio and it may be lower risk, just going to take a little bit longer. If it's a crisis-driven innovation, then the next thing to check is, how confident are we that this crisis is going to materialize? Because we've seen several examples in the past where people held out great hope about the potential market that would be created by a new piece of legislation. Take, for example, ballast water treatment. Many, many people believed that that was going to be like it was a gold rush mentality set in around ballast water treatment. The same was true of selenium, the removal of selenium, but a delay in regulations meant that that market didn't quite materialize as quickly as people thought that it would. And a current one to look at would be PFAS, to try and determine how quickly will the regulations be adopted for PFAS. So if it's crisis driven, just try and make sure you're reasonably confident that that is going to materialize, and not just materialize in a small segment of the market, that it's widespread enough that you have a significant opportunity. The next thing perhaps to think about would be, look at the technology and its offering and say, what type of innovation is this? If it's sustaining innovation, then that may be well best left to the incumbents. And that is not a good opportunity for a venture capital investor. License it to the incumbents by all means. You know, and a good example there would be a rackless UF module. Some of the Xenon folks came up with that, and it's a great sustaining innovation. Now, you might also say, is this radical functionality, does it allow us to do something we could never have done before? For example, detecting leaks from outer space with satellites. And if it provides that radical functionality, ideally check if there's a crisis to drive it, because in the water sector, we don't generally do things that we do not have to do. We don't buy additional functionality unless we need to do it. So in our experience, things which are have radical functionality but are value-driven, they hit a ceiling. Take, for example, Ostara, struvite recovery. It's a radical new thing to be able to generate a fertilizer at a wastewater treatment plant, but you don't have to do it. The people that did that first, the early adopters for Ostara, were doing it primarily because their pipes were being blocked by struvite. They actually were crisis-driven adopters. But once you'd exhausted that portion of the market for these people who were really struggling with blocked pipes, now you're trying to get people to buy this based on the value. And I think that's where it gets slowed down. So I think radical functionality is great, but it needs to have some form of need to drive it. And then the third type would be discontinuous innovation. So if you're looking at a technology and you say, oh, that's interesting, it's doing something we did, but doing it differently. For example, a ceramic membrane or a UV LED, that can take the market that's already there. It's not creating a new market. It's taking a market that's already there, like fine bubble diffusers did. And if that discontinuous innovation is competitive enough, if the costs, be they capital, operation, or efficiency gain, are significant enough, then it absolutely can wipe the market clean. So knowing where you stand in that matrix allows you to determine what could be the right strategy or the right expectations or the risk profile. And in our experience, when we've looked at these case studies, the technologies that created unicorn markets that became, you know, over $1 billion markets in the long run, combined elements, they were discontinuous with radical functionality. So they had both components in common. They could be either value-driven or crisis-driven. That only affected the timeline for impact. So I think those could be interesting ways to filter in a stage gate your thinking process as you come across these opportunities.
Okay, let's go from innovation in general to the diffusion theory of innovation, because at the end, that is the process of how to get the innovation spread in water. Can you explain a little bit the types of innovation that you've identified and which ones are most prevalent in the water sector?
We began to realize that innovation is a broad brush term and it can mean different things. And as an investor, Reinhard, you're looking for a certain type of innovation. If you're a utility, it might mean something slightly different to you. If you're Suez and you're trying to extend your brand line that you already have, it's a different thing as well. So when we dug into this, we found A, the theory of disruptive innovation was being widely used with no real reference back to what it actually meant. You know, like anything could be called disruptive. And when you break it right back, like disruptive innovation means either it creates a new business model, a new value chain, and a lot of technologies that were being labeled as that didn't comply with that. So we came across some other innovation theory where people talked about radical functionality. You know, it could enable you to do something you could never do before, like my iPhone, my iPad. You know, these a phone never did these things before. It didn't function as a computer and a camera and everything else. It was radical functionality. And that we said, oh yeah, I can see this in water. Certain technologies have radical functionality. An MBR, you don't need a clarifier anymore. There was another type of innovation called discontinuous, and it meant that you simply use different components, different materials, but it did the same thing. It was discontinuous and it created a new value chain. So aerators, it aerated, it wasn't a radical function, but it was using different components. You use fine bubble diffusers as opposed to surface aerators. And in water at the moment, you could say UV LED is discontinuous. It uses an LED as opposed to a mercury filled amalgam lamp. And we thought this is useful. Now we can stand back from innovations at quite an early stage before they're out there in the field. And we can say, oh, that's actually discontinuous. It's clearly using a different component. And ceramic membranes, for example, are discontinuous. They're not polymeric. And then you could look at radical functionality and you could look at sustaining. And then we could say, okay, which of these moves faster or slower than others? And what's the best strategy? Do some of these things work better in the hands of a venture capital investor? Do some of these work better in the hands of incumbents? And that became an interesting lens that we could utilize at an early stage, because that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to anticipate early on.
So I think this is a very good distinction. And radical functionality is obviously the scarcest one and is the one that is, by definition, if it actually solves a problem, disruptive. Discontinuous can sometimes be disruptive because of the big financial savings or because of certain operating effects that make it possible to do something completely differently, but mostly are not. And then sustaining, we don't even need to talk about in that respect. And indeed, whenever you talk to people, everything is disruptive, and in reality, almost nothing is. So let's first look at what players are best positioned possibly to bring such different types of innovation to the market and why. And then we can use examples give some flavor on why this is the case and where it was successful and where it failed.
That was one of the things we were really keen to figure out through the course of this research work is, you know, are things better suited? What's the right strategy? What's going to work here? You know, one of the challenges with a lot of the disruptive innovation theory is it's easy to look in the rearview mirror. It's easy to look back in time at computer hard disks and study it. It's already happened. What we're trying to do is we're trying to figure out, looking forward over the next 10 or 20 years, like what's going to make sense. So you need a model and you need to look at data in the past, but you need to be able to predict it early. You can't just always wait. It's easy to say why something happened after it's happened. You can pretty much, you know, interpret it whichever way you wish to suit your thesis. Discontinuous innovation is best generally left to new entrants. And you can see that already happening with things like UV LED. It's not Trojan, it's not Wedeco that are really driving this market because it's disruptive, right? It's like the same reason maybe digital cameras weren't spearheaded by Kodak. It's not always the case, okay? And there are exceptions to that rule. But if we look at, like, why would it suit a new entrant? He does not have a factory. They're not tied to polymeric membranes. They don't have that expertise in material science. There's nothing stopping them using ceramic membranes. There's no reason why. In fact, they have every reason to want to do it because it gives them a way into this market rather than trying to come in and compete against a commodity market where margins are low and there are already three or four gigantic players in there that have a very strong share of the market.
I like the thinking because I think the problem for incumbents is a discontinuous innovation would cannibalize some of their existing business. And hence, there's an organizational resistance to developing something like that. The factory is a good point, right? You have a factory for polymeric membranes. You rather optimize the polymeric membranes than to think about ceramic membranes, because it's a completely different manufacturing process and there's zero synergies between the two other than on the sales side. In many cases, my hunch is these new entrants at some point still need to sell their business to one of the incumbents, because the go-to market is still incredibly hard in such a fragmented industry such as water. And when the incumbents are desperate enough to realize that this will cannibalize their business anyways, they will happily embrace it before losing the market to somebody else. Do you agree with that? Or
I think everyone's carrying a baton in a relay race here. And you know, when we look at the 12 to 16 years, there's a certain type of person or individual or group or team members that can get through the first 6 or 8 years. And there's another group that are very good at the next 6 to 8 years. But at a certain point of time, the baton often, and it often makes sense to hand it off to somebody that has that type of market reach you describe. Xenon was an upstart, startup company, an outsider, but became, you know, part of GE relatively early on in its life cycle. And that gave them access to market. Currently, DuPont has acquired OxyMem, an MAB, or membrane-rated biofilm reactor, relatively early on in its life cycle. They had a number of plants out there, and of course, DuPont can give market reach in a highly fragmented market. Suez are actually bringing an MABR to market, so they're in some ways an exception to the rule because they're a large company, but that technology came with Xenon. It was an innovation on the shelf of Xenon, which sat there for a while, and then some of the original guys brought it to market. It can actually help if you've got a small company and a larger company. The MABR market, Memcor, was operating at the same time as Xenon was. The radical functionality, again, quite well suited to a new entrant, but it can also be brought to market by existing players. But I do think there's a certain time in the life cycle of a company when being a one-trick pony becomes a little bit tricky. And it can make sense to have your offering part of a larger entity. So you've got these synergies. You'll see a certain number of companies will fail. And then 10 years later, a number of new companies will come back and try a similar idea. And then if that didn't work, it maybe tried a third time. And it might succeed the third time because maybe conditions have changed. The economics could be different. The technology could have moved on. There are always people out there with that level of optimism and idealism, but you know, understanding the past can definitely save you time, save you risk. There are new causes for optimism in water. So water reuse technologies, because of the drivers we have now, the crises around water reuse, or it could be PFAS would be a current example. I always feel it's a terrible shame when you see an innovator or an entrepreneur or an investor that devotes, you know, years of their life and, you know, doesn't get the success that they deserve or have the impact that they wish to have. And as I saw that pattern, that was one of the motivators that I felt to start Blue Tech, was to try and help increase the rate of success, because there's only so much capital. There's only so many investors who are willing to take a bet. There's only so many entrepreneurs out there, but the challenges are huge and they're not going away.
When we talk about discontinuous and radical functionality innovation, there's not like hundreds of them every year. It's more a handful in a decade or something like that. And if you keep that in mind, what crosses my mind is you must be pretty crazy to found a startup in the water sector, believing that you are one of this handful in a decade. What's your take on that?
Well, usually when somebody thinks about water, and the first reaction is that is a big opportunity. So when the classical Palo Alto venture capital funds were very excited about the clean tech movement, when water was mentioned, it always gets past the first hurdle, because of course it makes sense intuitively that we need to be investing in water. But there was a naivete about the very first round of investments we saw when Draper Fisher Jurvetson made an investment into Oasis, or Kleiner Perkins into APT, or Vantage Point into Ostara. And the common denominator there with almost all of these is that they did not get home runs, or they did not get an exit that covered the original investment. But there were one-off plays. People made one bet in water, dipped their toe in the proverbial water to see what it was like, but without a very deep understanding of it. Whereas what we're seeing now is there's much more sophistication coming to bear in investment in water. I mean, look, funds like Skion have a very clear strategy, which is very different to, say, the strategy of, you know, XPV or Emerald Technology Ventures, which have been very successful. So I think the success is in specialization. It's understanding what is your niche, what is your strategy in water, rather than simply picking one company that you like the sound of and making an investment and hoping for the best.
I mean, my personal recommendation to people who have an idea that could potentially be innovative in water always is embrace partnerships as early in the process as possible, because you will face the challenge of, is it radical or discontinuous enough? And you will only find out if you talk to people who know more about this, have more experience than you perhaps have, especially in terms of the customer perspective. Is it something that has to be integrated in a complicated way into the value chain? Is it something that is difficult from a sales channel point of view because of the fragmentation of the industry? So do you agree that more collaboration is needed for innovation to happen than there is happening right now?
I think it's becoming more collaborative. I see a lot of the corporations becoming much more involved, more in seeking innovation and adopting innovation. I'm thinking of groups like Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, L'Oreal, Heineken, Apple, Intel, Walmart, et cetera, in that they're becoming much more a part of the process rather than simply being at the end of the chain. They know what they need to achieve within their own organizations, and they look actively and they partner in piloting, and that's really valuable for a startup. Probably the biggest mistake the startups make is they think that the world is out there waiting for this one little widget that's going to solve everything, and maybe they don't have the applications expertise. I do think also companies like Xylem, Suez are becoming more, DuPont, becoming more collaborative in their approach with startups as well.
I think that's a good point. At the end, it's also really to get the customer involved earlier and get feedback on, is there a need for what you have in mind, rather than first developing it in 10 iterations and then trying to find the market and problem for it.
You know, there's a lot of zombie technologies out there as well, where it's Edward de Bono, who's best known for his work in lateral thinking, says that, a door that opens up instead of out, it's just a different type of door, right? It's not necessarily innovative. And, doing something, one of the examples we came across in the thesis was photocatalytic oxidation. The use of titanium dioxide with ultraviolet light for oxidation. And it just seems like the literature is so rich, there's been so much published in the area, but it hasn't really taken off. And the question is it a zombie technology? It's not moving with anything like the velocity we would expect, even allowing for the slow rate of adoption in water. And why is that? Does it truly do anything better than, or cheaper or faster or more efficient than? Is there a pain point that cannot be met with, say, hydrogen peroxide in UV or ozone and hydrogen peroxide or some other form of oxidation? That's critical that people are realistic about that from the get-go. Bioelectrochemical systems is similar. Bioelectrochemical systems, incredible amount of published literature on this. Citations are, off the charts. It's a great area to publish in, really exciting. But what real world impact has it actually had? Really very, very little. It's negligible. With some of the exceptions being the use in sensors, for example, which makes a sensible application of bioelectrochemical technologies. And it's to be vigilant for this type of thing, and to be vigilant for the hype versus the actual, and if you're going to be an investor and give 3 or 4 years of your life to something, let's try and spend it in the right thing, rather than coming away a little bit, disillusioned 3 or 5 years down the line. And that's not really going to help the sector as a whole to move forward.
Now we're doing innovation not just for the fun of it. We're doing it to achieve an impact, either for the environment or for the affordability of water and wastewater systems, or for the benefit of people who at the moment don't yet have access to proper water and wastewater infrastructure. You also looked at how can we assess the impact that a technology has, which is not so straightforward as one would think. What were the biggest difficulties in coming up with an impact score, or whatever you want to call it, for water technologies?
So we often get asked, Can you give us an example of a unicorn in water? Okay, the unicorn being your classic Silicon Valley billion-dollar company. Well, they're you know, billion-dollar startup companies privately held. They're not out there. They're not out there. So we said, what about billion-dollar markets, unicorn markets, that the market itself grew to be $1 billion? We thought, even that bar is quite high. There were very few who were getting above that threshold. So we thought about, what about a $500 million market? Maybe if something grows from zero to 500 million, that's a meaningful hurdle. And then as we got deeper into this, because we really wanted to find out what was actually having an impact, we thought, okay, what about the number of countries it's adopted in? Maybe it's adopted in 10 countries or 25 countries. That would give you a measure of how globally and widely it's being adopted. Another metric we worked on was just the total number of plants that are out there. Is it 100 plants in the world? Is it 500? Is it over 1,000 plants in the world as indicative thresholds? And there were some metrics that we tried, Reinhardt, that just didn't work. So we thought, what about the percentage of all treatment plants that use that technology? And it turned out that just wasn't a practicable metric in the real world, because you've got all these existing infrastructure plants. Like, it's different. In China, 50% of all new drinking water treatment plants may use membranes. But globally, nothing like 50% of drinking water treatment plants use membranes. So we settled on things we thought were practical and useful, and those were three. And then when we applied those, we said, okay, let's filter and sort here. And it surprised me. I was surprised at how low the impact can be, thermal hydrolysis and Ostara were, although I view those as very successful examples of technology commercialization. We all would. They have gone and they've introduced and proven these technologies, but the market for the thermal hydrolysis market currently is still under $100 million a year. You're still looking at under 500 reference plants globally, I think probably even still under 100 or tipping close to it. And then we found the unicorns, the ones that were at the higher end, were membrane bioreactors, ultraviolet disinfection, UF membranes. These are really significant markets. And then there are ones in the middle. And we looked then at how long does it take to go from a low level of impact to level two impact to the unicorn level of impact. And we found that once you're going at all, like once you're moving, you can move from level two impact to level three impact, that unicorn status. You can do that in a relatively modest amount of time, you know, within a decade. But it's the ones that kind of get stalled out for more than 10 years at level one. Those are the ones to perhaps watch. And I view it like an airplane taking off. You know, if you haven't reached cruising altitude within 20 minutes and you haven't been told you can stand up now and take off your safety belt and walk around the airplane, you know, you might be getting a bit worried. So that was some of the initial thoughts that we had. And it was one of the more interesting parts of the thesis, actually, to look at this.
The one metric that I could think of on top could be something like number of people impacted in a positive way by this, because then you get also the size of the plants that are retrofitted or equipped with that technology and so on. Did you think about using that one as well?
We did. And we looked at like similarly total volume of water treated, which is a proxy in a way for total number of people. And what you can get into there is aberrations that certain technologies that are suitable, for example, MFC Sabre technology is suitable for smaller population equivalents. You might get an aberration then for a technology that one plant could treat, you know, 500,000 people. That was one of the challenges with that piece of data and different scales of technologies. Also, when you looked at industrial as well, and we wanted to consider technologies which are used in industrial applications, then you can't apply that metric about number of people.
It's a good point, because I on reflection also agree that sometimes like a problem like PFAS might be very local because of the pollution, but still it's a super big problem for a certain number of people. And if you roll up the PFAS treatment market, you might have globally a relatively small share of a water market and only affect a certain number of people, but still you solve a major problem that affects large numbers of people. So yeah, the size is not everything, and number of people, that's a good point. It's difficult, but can you give examples of one to two high impact technologies that you found particularly inspiring or important?
One that I've seen in my own lifetime, right, would be the membrane bioreactor. So I always think this is a useful one. Like when I graduated from my first master's degree in water in 1997, my first job was at the body shop manufacturing facility, and people were talking about an MBR. I overheard people saying, "Oh, have you seen these new MBRs?" And it was like hushed tones, you know, like, what is this thing? Has anyone seen one? And a year or two later, I found myself running a pilot for Pfizer Pharmaceuticals in a head-to-head competition between Xenon and Kubota with an MBR. And this was exciting, right? Yeah. Like it was a race to, and one was going to win and one was going to lose. And in that particular instance, Xenon won. And then over that next few years, this is like late 1990s, by the mid 2000s, these were being widely adopted. And nowadays, it's a billion-dollar market with well over a thousand reference facilities, multiple players. So I've observed that one experientially in my own career. So these things can happen. And yeah, it's a question of like, what could be the next ones? And it took audacity in the part of Andrew Benedict in particular. So leadership, I think, was actually quite instrumental in that journey as well.
So now, as an investor or innovator, can I somehow try to assess the impact potential before I embark on my journey? How much potential impact could what I want to do have, so that I don't, in the end, put a lot of time and effort into something that somehow can't have a lot of impact?
Yes, I believe you can. I believe you can. I think if you look
run through the logic as part of the business plan exercise to look at the different elements of impact and figure out what is achievable, how big is the theoretical potential on each, and then the higher it is, the better your chance that if it works, it also has.
The ideal scenario is you have a number of factors all weighing in your favor. If you come across a technology company, you know, the questions that are interesting to ask are, does this feel like a value-driven innovation, or does this feel like a crisis-driven innovation? Maybe there's a little bit of both, right? Maybe it has a smaller footprint and it removes nitrogen to low levels, right? So you've got both factors weighing in your favor. That's the ideal situation. If you find it's a value-driven innovation, you might want to be more patient. You might want to say, okay, that one in my portfolio will eventually make its way forward bit by bit as people replace the assets, but no one's going to rip out the asset and put it in. Like, I'm not going to send my car off to the scrap heap because it's doing 45 miles to the gallon instead of 55 miles to the gallon. But the next time I buy a car, I'm going to go for that one. So your value driven might take you longer, a bit more of a sure bet. Your crisis driven ones are where you get the big wins and the big flops. People bet on ballast water treatment, crisis driven market, but it didn't materialize.
The crisis didn't happen because it was a regulation-driven market and not a crisis-driven market, right, in reality.
Yeah, you got to be really sure that's going to happen. And when I was discussing this work with Case, I said, Case, it seems kind of random to me. It's like if I planted a bunch of seeds, some seeds over here will grow, and it's like the rain fell. And that was what happened. And there was no more merit other than this. So you got to be really sure that crisis is going to hit, the regulation is going to come into force. And if it doesn't, for example, a change in the US administration can cause a derogation or a pushback. Then you find yourself in a situation, particularly for a startup company, where they only have a few million dollars of funding and only a certain amount of time. Selenium was a great example. A lot of startups went out of business when the Selenium regulations did not hit when people thought they were going to hit. The people who survived were groups like Veolia that had an MBBR that could do that, but they had other markets that could buffer them and get them through that period of time.
Now, let's look at the investment side even a bit more. There's lots of people who say there's not enough money available for innovation in water and we need to invest more into innovation in water. I have a slightly cynical view in that respect, because when I look at how much money is sunk into water technologies that never will have a chance to make it in the real world, my personal take is there's far more than enough money. There's not enough good ideas out there. Do you have a view on that?
Look, the goal here is to create value in solving water challenges. Be they in the emerging economies, like you mentioned, people who do not have access to water, do not have access to clean, safe water or sanitation, protecting the environment, reducing the carbon emissions that we have in this industry as a whole, you know, protecting the environment from eutrophication. That's where you create the values in solving those problems. there's been a very consistent rate of investment into water. Like, as we've monitored this for 10 years, we consistently see a continuous supply of new entrepreneurs coming through the innovation tracker. It never ceases to amaze me, just the volume and the rate at which that happens. Secondly, the rate of investment has been at least sustained, and I think it's been increasing in the past number of years into startup companies. There's an appetite out there for capital to solve water challenges. One of the things that I've come to observe from studying this is many of us are victims of Maslow's law of the hammer, where, you know, because you have a hammer, everything begins to look like a nail. And because we like doing things with membranes, then the membrane is the solution to our problems. The bigger opportunities to create value in solving water challenges may well be at a systems level, not necessarily looking at an isolated one particular technology. It could be the sanitation economy, how you reimagine an economy that can fund itself based on the service element of it, or at least partly fund it. That's an alternative approach. Blue-green infrastructure, where you address scarcity, floodings, storms, nutrifications, but not just with one technology at the end of a pipeline. Complex solutions that combine data, digital, plus blue-green. And those are more complex to imagine. Water reuse, for example, is a systems level change. If you go towards water reuse, indirect potable reuse, if you go towards a circular economy. And I feel that those things will also work in the same time cycles, that it will take us the same type of timelines to get through the adoption of them. So the opportunities for investment may be things that are enablers to the systems level change, as opposed to simply, you know, there's an expression, swapping deck chairs on the Titanic. Mm-hmm. The things which stand a chance to move the needle, those are the ones that I think can create the most value for society in the longer run. And if your technology fits into that paradigm and that shift, that to me, where I would be looking.
I fully agree. And I think when we look at the water technology companies that went through significant amounts of money and that fail, it is also linked often to their innovation being a product that is in search for a problem, rather than having the system level perspective in mind.
Yeah, just to pull back up a little bit and have that systems level view of where you see the sector going. And then your technology is an enabler and a part of that. And then you're being buoyed up by an overall trend. And that trend towards decentralization, for example, currently that we're seeing both in the developed and the developing worlds, is providing opportunities for integration of technologies such as, yes, MBR, but also digital technologies, sensor technologies, better use of automated control. But they're doing that in the context of a shift towards something that's coming at the problem from a different angle.
Okay, now let's go into failures. We'll do a bit on failures, right? Because it would be sad not to. We'll tie it into the we had this section about, is there enough innovation or not enough innovation or not enough money, right? And my point being that there's too much money and not enough innovation. We already talked about the question whether there's not enough innovation or not enough money available in the water sector. I have a bit of a cynical perspective on this, as you know, because I think there's too much quote stupid unquote money chasing too little good ideas. And I think one way to prove my point is that there are spectacular failures in terms of themes or companies where double or triple digit millions have been invested with no chance for success. Are there examples that come to your mind for this?
I mean, look, some people would say that the venture capital community is guilty of throwing too much money at companies and thinking that that's what's going to make it go faster, you know, throwing a lot of gasoline on the fire. But you can't, in some ways, you know, throwing a lot of money at something doesn't necessarily guarantee success at all. You're far better off in some ways spending less money over a longer period of time. There are spectacular failures, and many of them are where people were waiting for a crisis. For example, people have been saying that sludge application to land is going to be banned for many, many years, 20 years that I can count. And MaxWest, for example, people might recall, is a sludge gasification company. They raised over $55 million. Enertech, again, raised significant amounts of money for the slurry car process. There were a whole suite of them, actually. And I remember when I first got involved, people would say, oh, I saw that 10 years ago, or oh, I remember seeing someone trying pyrolysis or gasification. And now I've been around long enough for people to say that, oh, I remember, I've seen that before. And, you know, sometimes it is down to technical issues, as I think you've noted, Reinhard, that there are fundamental technical challenges, but those are some examples where it's a graveyard of either failed technologies or technologies that haven't gone anywhere.
Yeah, I would agree with that example. We looked at between 5 and 10 gasification technologies because land application is banned in Germany now. So there's now a massive build out of incineration plants, and all the gasification technologies had issues one way or other. One key theme was the ash melting point of sludge that was a challenge, and then tar formation. But there's also issues with the handling of the material and issues with the energy balance and all kinds of other problems. So none of the ones we saw, even at relatively large scale, made it into a commercial installation, and not a second one was built. It is a dream to make gasification work, but I unfortunately assume it will remain a dream.
Yeah. No, there are some unique materials handling issues there that people run into at scale that make it tricky. You know, people are trying hydrothermal carbonization, but you're correct. There's been an awful lot of money has been invested into that area, and really very little to show for it.
When I look at the influence of regulation on the diffusion adoption of water technology, how much of a role can regulation play in this? And what would be a good example of a theme that is purely driven by regulation?
Well, one example I'd love to give would be if you go back in time and history. The idea of adding chlorine to water was very radical. Like, people did not like the idea of adding, you know, a really dangerous chemical into your water. It just was a crazy idea at the time. It was done in Belgium for the first time ever in a continuous basis in a drinking water treatment plant about 1900. In 1910, they used it in New Jersey, but there was a big court case. And the court case had evidence as to why it would kill bacteria and control cholera and typhoid. And eventually, the evidence was upheld, and the decision was taken to allow the addition of chlorine to drinking water in New Jersey in 1910. 10 years later, by 1920, 75% of all, you know, municipal people who were connected to municipal supplies were drinking chlorinated drinking water. That's a really rapid rate of adoption, driven by crisis and the need to deal with bacteria and death in that was resulting at that point in time. Now, we've largely addressed most of these major crises in water over the past, you know, 50 to 100 years. Now we're looking at crises that are emerging, like PFAS, and the fact that we know there are many, many chemicals in our water that are potentially detrimental to us when they're present in combination above certain concentrations. If that materializes, it creates the market. The actual success rate of 9% isn't that out of kilter with other areas within, you know, technology investment. The real problem is that people don't fail fast enough, or they seemed to coast along for 10, 15 or more years where they're kind of in a gray zone and they're neither making it nor going out of business. They kind of hang around there for quite a long time before they either go one way or the other.
Which means for investors, maybe it's smarter to not be an early investor into these companies, but wait until some investors have burned through their money in that company. And when then finally there's a market or the product works or whatever, you come in as a third or fourth investor, you have the liquidation preference to your advantage anyways, and you make a much better deal than being an early one, being afraid of missing out on something.
Well, there's an expression, you know, that the early bird catches the worm, but in water, it's probably more often what we say, the second mouse that gets the cheese.
Yeah.
You know? And I could equally well say that Nano H2O is a success story and a failure story, because for the first investor, it's probably a failure, you know, and for the final investor, it's probably a success. So it really does depend whose perspective you're looking at this from. And you can see success and failure equally in these stories, depending on what hat you're wearing and when.
Yeah, good point. Let's hope I wear the right hat enough times.
Yeah, indeed. And if you're a patient investor and you know what you're, you know, I mean, the people who invested in Wedeco, for example, that was an early, you know, it was one of the very first companies to invest in ultraviolet light. They did well. They're still doing well on the back of that. So it's not that you can't make money by being the first investor, but you have to be very careful.
So what would your recommendations to investors be who want to invest into innovative technologies in the water sector?
I think first of all, understand that the water sector is just a loose association of things that happen to be linked thematically by water. So, you know, I break that down and decide, are you interested in digital applications in water or perhaps in commercial and residential innovations? Is it very technology-led, that you're looking for a technological breakthrough that can be the next Energy Recovery Inc. that can literally make a step change in performance and will wipe away everything else in its path? Then you've got to be really technically evaluating your opportunities to make sure that they have the potential to deliver that step change. So understanding A, the sector, your niche, and what exactly you're hoping to achieve, whether it's radical functionality and it's got to be a massive step change, or whether it's discontinuous, you want to be the Tesla here, that you're going to want to, you're going to replace all the polymeric membranes with ceramic membranes. Understand the broader landscape in which you operate and what's happening in the next 10 years. Where are we heading to? Where's the policy going? Where's the regulation going? What are the corporations doing in their move towards carbon neutrality? How does that impact water? And get a very realistic expectation of your timelines. Know that it may take a certain number of years to create value, but you're adding value each step of the way. If you invest 10 million today and in 6 years' time the company's worth 50 million, that's okay. Maybe then you can exit to a larger player. So understanding the life cycle of your portfolio, how long each thing is going to take, what level of real world impact you can have, and break it down early on to have a lens and a framework by which to look at these companies and even try and sort them and filter them would be some practical advice. Yeah.
The only thing I would add to that, or not add, but emphasize, is be realistic on the timelines. Look at the timelines you investigated as part of your research and match that with the timelines you have for the money you have from somebody that you need to return to that somebody. And if your timeline doesn't match the fund duration, then you have a problem. If the innovation timeline is 16 years and the fund duration has 5 years, it just won't work.
Look, absolutely. And you see that over and over again, that the first investor can be really paving the way for investor number three. If you look at Nano H2O, success story, prima facie. However, there were many investors that came in, and the ones that really succeeded may have been the people in the later rounds.
Yeah, maybe it's stupid to be the first, right? Investing into water technology, because there's many, many examples like that, where subsequent investors then finally think they made it work. And in reality, maybe the time it needed was just that long, and they were the lucky ones who came in late, and it had nothing to do with them making it work. It was just not possible to do it faster.
Well, you do get the patient money and the visionary money, and some of the people that founded the Wedeco UV system are still enjoying the success of that original investment, and they were one of the first founding investors in the company.
There's exceptions to the unfortunate rule, right? Very good point. Okay. I mean, the research you've done is really comprehensive and insightful for both innovators and investors. And I hope people take some of the key lessons learned very seriously, because it could make the difference between wasting a lot of money on useless endeavors and deploying it in things that will make a difference in the water sector and have impact. What are the areas where you think follow-on research still should be done?
Well, I mean, look, first of all, thank you for taking the time to have the conversation. I'm conscious that there's, you have the experience directly in the water sector, having worked within utilities to understand what it's like, reality is like. Your portfolio companies are broad enough that you've seen all sorts of different innovations across the value chain in industrial, municipal, large scale, small scale. And that makes this a very meaningful conversation to have. I think that was one of the goals for this work, was that people could actually have an informed conversation, that we could all sit around now and say, I see, look, let's look at the data. And I think one of the hopes I have is that it leads to that. It leads to, this is something that people will refer to and say, process things in those timelines. That's first point. And I'm grateful for the fact that you've done that and taken the time to read it. And I hope that others will find it engaging as well. it was made to be readable. The second piece is follow-on work. We're able working on a conversion of the PhD thesis into a book, which we hope would find its way into university libraries for people who are studying engineering or science or any aspect of water, that would be a foundational piece of their curriculum, that they would learn this side of water in parallel with learning everything else about the technical aspects of water, because it prepares them for the real world. So when we talk about investments in water, yes, it happens with private equity and venture capital. It also happens in universities. And you know, less than 1% or even 0.1% of all those ideas make their way out into the world. So it's important that we start there, bring it forward into the real world. And I'm interested in looking a little bit more at leadership, because as we got towards the end of the work and all the people that I spoke with who helped me by providing data, who were very collaborative. That was one of the amazing things about this process. There was a spirit of collegiality that everyone was willing it forward and was very forthcoming and willing to share their own experience. And I'm thinking of people like James L. Barnard, who pioneered biological phosphorus removal, Hank Vanderland, founder of Trojan UV, Andrew Benedict from Xenon, that you noticed over time there was also a pattern. They made good decisions. They were very bought into a bigger purpose. Those leaders were very bought into a bigger purpose of what they were trying to do with their technologies. It wasn't just about, I need to exit in 5 years' time, you know, for X multiple. And that vision must have been part of what sustained them through the timeline that was required to do that. And so I think that's an interesting part of this that I'd like to explore some more.
That is a good point. I mean, it's a knowledge-driven industry. There's not so much hard IP. So the people theme actually is also relevant later on when you deliver solutions to customers. You might have a good product, but the application know-how of the product is still what typically makes a difference, which ties into your system thinking comment earlier. So to be successful as a company, you also need to build teams with that deep experience and expertise who stay long enough in your company so that you don't lose all the expertise again. So it has to be a slower moving cycle on the people side as well as maybe in certain type of tech companies. And it's a different type of person needed for that. But on the flip side, there's a high intrinsic motivation and openness, because most people in the water sector actually are in the water sector, not just because it's a nice job, but also because it's something meaningful, because it affects all people in their everyday lives.
That resonates. I think that does resonate with people.
So what has been the impact of your research for your work at BlueTech?
It's been surprising. So this began when one of my team said he wanted to go back and do a PhD, and I really wanted to hang on to this guy. He was very good. And I asked if there was any way he could do it through the company. And Kay Spousman, who's the research director at WETSIS and a professor of Wageningen, introduced me to the concept of doing an external PhD. And I thought that could be a very interesting way to view the work that we were doing at BlueTech through an academic lens. I've been surprised at how much it's enriched the business and the research practice. It's informed our thinking. It's given us new models to apply to the data that we receive. It's a philosophy that we think in a different way because of the thesis. And I think it's helped that people understand that there's rigor behind the work that we do, that we're very data-driven. And we do take the time to give a lot of thought to this. And we speak with a lot of people in the industry to look at the various factors, and that there's a commitment there, you know, a bit like the entrepreneurs who have a bigger purpose. There's a commitment there that we, you know, genuinely, we want people to succeed.
So to say, you give some of your advice away for free by making it a proper book and publishing it, right? But on the flip side, that's the intrinsic motivation to make a difference to the water sector, that we want innovation to succeed and not to fail.
I think so, yeah.
So how do we measure the impact of your exercise? Do we measure it by how many startups did it well because they read the book? Do we measure it by how many scientists cited, how many books you sell? Can we agree on a metric here on this?
That's a good one. Well, the success of our clients, perhaps, is one thing I'd love to look at in the future. Yeah. The BlueTech Forum companies we work with. Citations, of course, is one element, right? Academically, that's often, yeah, that is the significance of your work is how much it's cited. It has been, actually, and I've noticed that you get these notifications popping up and letting you know this is happening. I think that's the next stage of growth, actually, is to really look at real world impact.
Yeah.
And that's something that I'm quite motivated to focus on, is work to make sure that the things that we're looking at and the people we're working with, you know, they're being adopted and used.
I mean, I think from my personal perspective, as you pointed out in the beginning, we had a conversation now. The research you did is the start of a conversation in the water sector, hopefully, where people reflect a bit more on what does it take for innovation to happen in the water sector, and how can you then support innovation versus how can you avoid the pitfalls that make a lot of money be wasted on stuff that never has a chance. That conversation will continue. We don't know what the book will look like when it's rewritten in 16 years, which is a typical adoption cycle in water, right? But yeah. Surely it will look different from what it was like 2 years ago when there was no book on this. I really hope that this conversation will lead to a better allocation of resources to things that have a chance, because we desperately need that in the water sector. And I mean, I'm sure with your work at BlueTech, you will continue to also support many companies and innovators in that respect. We as an investor will try our best to do the same. And I assume, given the collaborative nature of this sector, there will be others who will try to apply those lessons as well. I'm really curious to see when we revisit this in a few years, where we are on this.
Absolutely. Revision 2 or Revision 3, it'll be fascinating to see. Right. But yeah, we're all in the same boat in that sense, and it will be interesting to see where we are in a number of years' time.
All right. Thanks a lot, Paul. This was a fun conversation. Anybody who's interested in sharing an immediate reaction with us, obviously we are reachable, and we will respond, and we are happy to be challenged further, I guess.
Absolutely. Look, that's the idea, right? You put these things out there, you let us, like, you know, challenge them, see if they stand up, take on board any new viewpoints, revise your thinking if needs be, let other people pick up on it and develop them. That's the whole goal. So I knew it was going to be a good conversation, and I very much enjoyed it, and I appreciate your time and effort in helping explore these issues.